KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Pittsburgh, California.
Oh, I'm not from the Bay Area.
Pinole, California.
Coming up, in the aftermath of the ghost ship fire, we'll hear about a warehouse that is fighting to stay put.
I wish there was a way for there to be safety inspections on spaces like this that didn't threaten our existence.
Then we'll meet someone who was displaced by the ghost ship fire.
Quite a few of the other residents have just had to leave town because there's just nowhere to afford up here.
And we'll look back at one space that tried for years to comply with local permitting requirements.
You shut us down, you're going to have to push people to places that are far more unsafe.
Keeping the Bay Area's underground from disappearing and keeping it safe. That's today on Cross Currents. Today marks 3 months since the fire at the Ghost Ship Warehouse in East Oakland. 36 people died. A night of electronic music was just beginning when a fire broke out, engulfing the building in a matter of minutes, trapping partygoers in the difficult-to-navigate building. According to the New York Times, there was only one exit that most victims could have reached, and it was down a winding, makeshift staircase. The cause of the fire is still under investigation. KALW's economics reporter Jeremy Dalmas wanted to find out what's happened in the aftermath, so he went to the scene of the fire earlier this week.
I'm in front of the ghost ship right now on 31st at International, and even though the street is partially a quiet residential one, it's just a few hundred feet away from the main drag in Fruitvale, and a few blocks away from the Fruitvale BART station. The building is boarded up and surrounded with a fence, and there's a security guard posted out front. But even 3 months later, it still smells like a fire, and there are still dozens of fresh flowers out front.
The building that housed the ghost ship was originally built in 1930. Before people moved in residentially in 2013, the space had been empty for years. And while housing prices in the Bay have pushed more people into unpermitted rentals, locals have been living in industrial spaces since long before the current housing crisis. The early 1970s saw a wave of artists moving into unused spaces in San Francisco's SoMa and Mission districts. And while almost all of them are gone, some of these old-time collectives became part of the city's current arts establishment. Here's KALW's Jeremy Dalmas.
Instead of ringing a doorbell, Craig Baldwin told me to stomp on the metal plate in the sidewalk in front of his space on Valencia Street.
I'm probably the last straggling, you know, guy in the mission. I'm the leaseholder here, by the way.
Baldwin's lived here at Artist Television Access since they moved in 1987. They're a small theater and event space that focuses on film. Baldwin himself is a well-known experimental filmmaker, and he keeps his film archives in the basement. But before moving in, he lived at the iconic Project One.
Like a four-story building, five, you count the basement. There were 70, 78, 79 people in there, probably more at one point.
According to local historians, Project One was the first community of young artists who lived in an old industrial space in San Francisco. Before 1971, those spaces weren't available because they were still filled with industry. Large-scale manufacturing hadn't started to leave the city in earnest yet. Dozens of artists moved into this 84,000-square-foot old candy factory at 10th and Harrison in SoMa. Baldwin describes it as a multi-story vertical village with projects all over the building.
Like stained glass, or filmmaking, or silkscreen printing, or music studio. And in the first floor, there was actually a computer lab, one of the very earliest here.
Project One was for people who needed a large space, a studio, but their work couldn't fit into a normal house, and affordability was also crucial.
You see, the idea is if you lived in an apartment and then you had a studio somewhere else across town, you'd be paying two rents.
They would have been paying an average of around $400 a person to live and work there, adjusted for inflation. He says he could never have become an established filmmaker without that physical space. The economics for artists are the same now.
The cost of paying for the gallery space is made up for, see, by the renters.
Hosting music performances, films, and art shows provided a venue for lesser-known talents and, at the same time, helped residents pay the rent. But these spaces rarely last. Project One got evicted in the early 80s, and almost every other industrial arts space in San Francisco is long gone. But against the odds, there is one tenacious space in the Mission District that has survived for decades. This space is still there, and they're still relevant. This is a recording of Kronos Quartet performing there in 2010.
Arteau is beautiful if you go over there. They succeeded, you understand, for whatever reason.
Project Arteau started in 1971, right after Project One. They're in an old American Can Company factory that takes up a whole city block. They began with practically nothing.
But there was no walls, so it was unbelievable. It was just like open into this 40,000 square foot. It's amazing. It was a cathedral.
Nicole Sawaya used to manage the theater here. She moved into Project Arteau in 1978 and has lived here ever since. Like Craig Baldwin, she says that having both arts and living spaces in the same building was economically essential. There are still performances today, and dozens of artists still live here. They tend to be older, like Sawaya.
So here's my studio.
Oh, God.
When I got this studio, I sandblasted, because this was all painted, to take it down to the brick.
Just like Project One, and like contemporary live-in industrial spaces, when they first got in here, it was an empty shell, and they had to build everything themselves.
And then it was like screw guns and sheetrock all through the morning, noon, and night.
For the authorities, though, this was unprecedented. Sawaya says the city had never heard of having events in the same place where people lived. They condemned the building almost immediately. And this would have been the end of the line in other spaces. But Project Arteau had an ace up their sleeve, an advantage that few artist spaces had, then or now. They own the building.
And we wouldn't be here if back in 1971, those very, very smart people hadn't said, you know, forget about leasing it, let's buy it.
The city didn't make people stop living there, and Arteau worked with them slowly over the years to write new codes and get the building into compliance with existing regulations. It was a back and forth, beginning with sprinklers, fire doors, and exit signs.
But the city was pretty amazing back then. It was very elastic. We were in conversation with them for 10 years.
By 1984, the whole building was legal, and people have lived there legally ever since. And it's not just Project Arteau and Artist Television Access. Southern Exposure, The Lab, and Counterpulse are all pillars in the local arts establishment, and they all grew out of spaces of questionable legality in the 70s and 80s. But as it gets more difficult to use spaces like these, it gets harder to see what will seed the next generation of arts organizations in the Bay Area. For Crosscurrents, I'm Jeremy Dalmas.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Julie Kane, in for Hanat Baba. In San Francisco today, very few industrial spaces doubling as unpermitted homes remain. Most are in Oakland now. The Oakland mayor's office officially knows of 18, but other estimates say there are dozens more, maybe as many as 60. It's hard to know since so many of these spaces are illegal to live in and are trying to hide from the city to avoid evictions. But in the 3 months since the ghost ship fire, many spaces around the bay have gotten inspections or eviction notices. Warehouse residents are on edge, and not just because of increased scrutiny since the December fire. That fire came at the end of a year in which two of the most high-profile live-work spaces in West Oakland were evicted. 1919 Market, which housed dozens of people, and Lobot, which was well-known for music and art shows. Residents and artists in many other spaces fear they may also lose their homes. Here's KALW's Jeremy Dalmas.
Over the past 16 years, the people who've lived at the space Vague Threats have put a lot of work into their home.
This was all one empty space, right? And so we built a shower right here, and then we put in both these bathrooms as well.
Parts of the space are beautiful, but you can't hear about them. Margot isn't Margot's real name, and Vague Threats isn't even the name of this space. This is not a legal residence. It's just supposed to be art studios. And if they get found out, they're likely to lose their home. People have been tenuously living here since the early 2000s, before Margot's time.
And it was totally derelict. Kept being like, oh yeah, we're probably gonna get kicked out in 3 months or 6 months or a year, and then 2 years goes by.
The space used to be heavily involved in the local electronic music scene, but they've stopped hosting shows in recent years.
And all this time goes by and it's like, lots and lots of different people, and the landlord's just like, whatever, rent, whatever. I don't want to know anything. I don't want to deal with anything. I'm not going to fix anything.
Hands-off landlords are common in these spaces. Often, like here, renters have a commercial lease, which means they can be responsible for repairs and upgrades on the building. But they are also allowed to make renovations they could never do in a typical apartment. There's also a potential legal advantage. When a landlord can claim they didn't know anyone was living in their building, tenants have fewer rights to stay, and the landlord might not be held responsible if anything goes wrong. Vague Threats had relative stability for years. Then the fire happened. Bill, not his real name, lives here with Margot, and he knows people who died at Ghost Ship.
I went to my friend's funeral. It was a beautiful funeral.
On his way home, he realized what was going to happen.
And I was thinking, wow, they're gonna start coming after us if they're coming after people. And then it just started, like a train just coming through.
Within days, they got a notice from the city saying they were going to get inspected. Margot explains that it was all hands on deck.
We were all here for like 12 hours every day for like 14 days. And, you know, we all like also are getting in cars and going to memorials and fielding phone calls.
Even though this is triggered by the fire at Ghost Ship, they didn't just get a fire inspection. They got a building inspection, a health inspection, a plumbing inspection, an electrical inspection, and the police came by. And all this time, they're pretending they don't live there. These are inspections just to use the space as art studios. They passed the fire and the health inspection, but the space needs work, and there are thousands of dollars in fines. The landlord gave them an eviction notice, but Vague Threats was able to strike a bargain. They deal with everything, and in exchange, they get to stay.
Yeah, the only reason he's complying is because he's, again, not putting a single penny of the rent that we paid him over the last 16 years into this building. He was like, nope, no money for permits, no money for nothing. I don't want to hear about it.
But they're still in limbo because they're at the whim of their landlord. They're on a month-to-month commercial lease and have no tenant protections.
I wish there was a way for there to be safety inspections on spaces like this that didn't threaten our existence, because if you really want to talk about, that's how you have a system that actually saves people's lives.
Jonas Strauss is working on just that.
I have always lived and worked in warehouses since 2001.
Strauss is his real name, and he helped start the Oakland Warehouse Coalition.
Myself, I had a couple of days post-Ghost Ship of mourning and reflection for my friends and for the community. And almost immediately after the weekend ended, it became apparent that an organization was going to need to step in order to protect our rights.
He says that any safety problems that were in warehouses quickly got fixed after the fire. to him and his peers, dangers like the deadly winding pallet staircase at Ghost Ship were an outlier.
Nobody does that. Nobody uses those construction techniques. Nobody uses a bunch of pallets and builds rooms out of them and expects it to be sustainable.
And his organization is working to stop exactly the problem that is threatening spaces like Vague Threats. No tenant protections.
We've seen time and time again that as soon as there's a code complaint, as soon as there's a building inspection, it triggers a set of events that can, in a very real way, lead to you losing your home.
Their big push is to work with the city to pass the Emergency Tenant Protection Ordinance. It would temporarily give spaces the same protections that a typical apartment dweller has. And it has a path to turn the buildings into permanent affordable housing. Strauss points to a precedent from another disaster.
When we had the earthquake in 89, you had whatever it was, 3,200 buildings in the city of Oakland that got red tagged, and the city loosened its permitting process, and they loosened its inspection process.
He sees both the earthquake and the current crisis as emergency housing situations, and the solution to both is what he calls compassionate code compliance. And this ordinance wouldn't just protect warehouse-dwelling artists. It would cover everyone living in a unit that isn't legal according to the city. That could be a converted garage, an in-law unit, or a storefront. These are spaces that are all over Oakland. And the people living in them, who are often poorer and may not speak English well, have few tenant protections, and typically not a lot of resources.
There's a ton of them. There's no way that the building department is ever going to get to all of these, and it's important that these people are protected.
Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf issued an executive order in January that tried to ease some of the stress, but it falls well short of what warehouse dwellers want: full protection. And with the current state of housing around the Bay Area, warehouse spaces are staying in stealth mode. They don't trust the government. They just don't see the benefit. They feel like they made their homes fire safe themselves, and they fear that any official attention will start with a fight over building codes and end in an eviction. Back at Vague Threats, Bill wants life to go back to what it was before December.
We just want to live under the radar. We don't want to be above the radar. Just leave us alone, and everything will be fine.
But for now, there's no break. Today, they have to sweep the roof and check for leaks. For Cross Currents, I'm Jeremy Dalmas.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Julie Kane, and for Hanat Baba. While many people living in warehouses are worried they could lose their homes, those affected most immediately were the almost two dozen people who lived in the Ghost Ship. They woke up the morning after the fire homeless. Carmen Brito was one of them. She says she was the first person to call 911 that night and thinks she may have been the first person to see the fire.
My name is Carmen Brito, and I was a resident of the Ghost Ship. I moved in January 1st of 2016. Started a new year in a new place. But before that, it was just so difficult trying to find anywhere to live. I ended up bouncing around the East Bay for a while. You know, most of us are just grateful to find a room anywhere. You know, I was going through Craigslist, and the ad was just, well, one, like, the photos were just stunning, but it was just sort of a call for artists and weirdos and writers and people who still have to work and do art and people kind of living on the fringe. And, you know, it just felt like, oh, like, and this is what I've been looking for. Like, this feels like a home and a temple and an adventure all at the same time. I don't know, it's just that kind of thing where it's like, oh, hey, do you want to do that cool art thing? Do it. It's like, oh, you like doing graffiti? You can paint something on the back wall. You know, whatever you're into, do it. I think the first time the power went out was in For me, it was like the first month I moved in, the power went out. But we had maybe like one power outage for the whole month of January. And, you know, and then they just sort of like got slowly like more and more frequent, like in hindsight. I think the power went out something like two or three times the week before the fire. I'd been at work all day and I'd gotten home, you know, maybe 6:30 or 7. And I see Derek and Micah loading up their kids in their van. And I was like, oh, there's an event tonight. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, I had planned on going out. I had like three things I should have gone out to go do that night. And I ended up just kind of falling asleep. So I woke up to my studio filled with smoke and I could hear the music going. And I could see this sort of orange glow, and just like my perception of it was that it was a fire, but a fire like the size of a microwave or something like that. Like big, but like not horrible. And so I put on my shoes and my coat and didn't really think much about it. I guess I just sort of thought like, okay, we're gonna put it out and I'll be outside for a bit and then I'll come back. Like, I guess when I was leaving, I thought I was going to come back. And I step outside of my studio and I look and I see an entire wall on fire. And I was already dizzy and disoriented and I just headed for the front door. I got outside and somehow I had my phone with me and I started calling 911. If I'm the first person to see the fire, and it maybe takes me maybe a minute to get to the front door, another minute to call, and then less than 3 minutes for the fire department to get there. I mean, you know, that window of opportunity to have gone out of the building was less than 5 minutes. I think I watched it burn for about an hour before, you know, a couple of my friends came to get me. And they were kind of like, do you want to stay? Do you want to go? Do you want us to take you away from here? And I was kind of like, I think I need you to take me away because I'm just going to sit here. You know, kind of tried to sleep, drank some whiskey trying to sleep. And I think I blacked out for a little bit, like lost consciousness for a little bit, but I didn't sleep. And I woke up to one of the other people from the warehouse calling to make sure that I had been okay because she wasn't sure if I had made it out or not. You know, I just remember like the Saturday after like waking up and like seeing an image of my home on Fox News. And I was like, is this really happening? Like, did this really happen? You know, most of the residents spent the day at, you know, Saturday at the Red Cross. And they gave us these emergency debit cards with like $500 on it to go buy clothes. And yeah, because I was still wearing the clothes that I had made it out of the building with. So I was able to stay at a friend's house in Emeryville for a couple of weeks after the fire. I never slept for more than a couple of hours at a time. And yeah, I mean, it's like the last time I went to sleep comfortably, I woke up and my house was on fire. And I just realized like, I need a home now. I need another home. And I got really lucky that a friend of mine who I've known for like the last 10 years from my hometown had a room open up in a house that he's been living in for the last 5 years in Oakland. You know, I had wanted to move into another warehouse, but with all of the attention of everything going on, I wasn't exactly hearing back from people in warehouses, and I don't blame them. I really don't. It was just kind of like a little weird to feel like, oh, and I'm like 86th from warehouses now. Like, you know, I'd rather live somewhere with that sort of space and that creative energy. But, you know, I was one of the first people to find permanent housing again. And quite a few of the other residents have just had to leave town because there's just nowhere to afford up here. About six of them have relocated to Los Angeles. there's a couple still sort of hanging around the Bay Area, and, you know, around here, it's just even warehouse spaces are getting expensive. At this point, I think if people start leaving, they're not going to come back. They're just going to find a different city that's more affordable. And I don't know, I feel like this is a point in the history of Oakland and its artistic community of like it either gets better or it disappears. And I honestly don't know which way it's going to go.
Carmen Brito was one of the residents of the ghost ship. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Julie Kane, in for Hanat Baba. Events like the one thrown the night of the ghost ship fire used to be a regular occurrence all over Oakland, but they've virtually died out because venues fear drawing attention to themselves. Since December, the city has ramped up inspections, and last week, the Oakland Police Department started requiring officers to report all unpermitted events. But many who have run event spaces say that if the city wants to regulate them, more rules and bureaucracy will only push events further underground and may lead to more unsafe spaces. KALW's Jeremy Dalmas digs into what it takes to get an event permit in Oakland.
Back in July of 2010, Aja Archuleta played this show at 21 Grand, just months before the space was shut down by the city. Archuleta was one of the survivors of the ghost ship fire. He had been scheduled to play later that evening. And this performance at 21 Grand was part of the Mission Creek Music Festival, organized by fire victim Kiyomi Tanue.
My name is Sarah Lockhart. I was one of the founders and people who ran the Art Space 21 Grand in Oakland from the year 2000 to the year 2010.
21 Grand was a founding member of the Art Murmur Gallery Walk. Lockhart says that they were the first alternative art space in Uptown. Their bread and butter was music, but they also have visual art, dance, readings, and film screenings. At their height in 2008, they were hosting events every couple days.
The need was there. It's like we could have filled every single night of the week, but we were making money. We needed to work jobs.
After 7 years of events, one night while packing up, they were approached by the police.
And they just sort of came in, took a look, and are like, if we catch you doing this again, we're going to shut you down. And I was like, do I take this seriously? And then we're like, well, what would we need to do?
They thought that they were above board, and they wanted to be. After that night, they got shuttled from city department to city department, each one adding to a long checklist of things to do. And a lot of these departments didn't have good communication with one another.
And at the time that we had problems with the city, we were receiving grant money from the city to have shows.
After 2 years of red tape and thousands of dollars, 21 Grand finally figured out that in order to stay open, they would have to retrofit the building, install sprinklers, move the front door, and a bunch of other things. It would cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. They tried to move, but other spaces would have also required expensive retrofitting, or would have been double the rent. 21 Grand shut down in 2010. The building it was in is now an auto shop.
I mean, I told the city straight up when they first started cracking down on us that we're a nonprofit, we're concerned about safety. You shut us down and places like us down, and the only people who are going to still be doing things are you're going to have push people to places that are far more unsafe.
After the fire in December, almost 1,300 people signed a letter that was written by survivors and addressed to Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf. Part of that letter asked the city to reassess permitting policies, and then goes on to state, quote,
"The importance of this last demand is illustrated well by the case of 21 Grand, a venue that did everything it could to legitimately host experimental music, but was stymied at every point by an arduous city bureaucratic process."
At City Hall, Councilmember-at-Large Rebecca Kaplan says that she wants to fix the specific problems that plague 21 Grand. One idea is to make it much easier to interact with the city.
And so what I and others are asking for is a single point of contact permit that is not run by the police department.
But years after 21 Grand closed, there is still nothing on the table that deals with their biggest challenge. How does a nonprofit community space with little money either A, pay to upgrade the building, or B, afford a building that is already up to code to have events? And if they can't pay, and they hide instead, is the city any safer? The fire didn't create this problem, but it did intensify it. And like LiveWork spaces, event spaces have also been hit with inspections and eviction notices in recent months. Where are we right now?
Yeah, we're in the front part of Quilombo Community Center.
Vandell helps run Quilombo. They're a radical social center that focuses on Black and brown communities in West Oakland. They have a bookstore, a huge garden with chickens, and their doors are open for Domino's games since the city closed nearby St. Andrew's Park.
And then we have this room, but it's our healing space. We have a really large group of people who do massage and acupuncture and Reiki and, you know, yoga, everything.
There really isn't any other space like this. They're different from 21 Grand, but they are beginning to deal with some of the same issues. 2 weeks after Ghost Ship, Quilombo failed a fire inspection after passing them for years.
On the piece of paper that they gave us, it just said that we are not permitted to have public gatherings.
She says she believes their property manager, who had already tried to evict them before, called in the inspection on the property himself. That manager didn't respond to numerous calls for comment, but Dell says he showed up with the fire inspector and afterwards told Quilombo that their lease was void because of the failed inspection.
We came to the conclusion landlords were snitching on spaces that they knew weren't up to code because they were negligent.
This is hard to verify. Complaints are anonymous. So it's unclear who called in an inspection and why they did it. At worst, the system can be abused. At best, it leads to suspicion.
People need to be able to trust that the safety inspections really are for their safety.
And part of the Emergency Tenant Protection Ordinance, which is slowly being reviewed by the city, would solve this by requiring complaint filers to leave contact information.
I do think that there is a certain amount of pressure that people believe that they need to prove now after the fire that they're being tough.
Which is understandable. There was just a fire. The fire department also didn't respond to calls for comment, so we don't know if they are actually getting tougher. The city is right now walking a tightrope, balancing their responsibility to keep spaces up to code, dealing with a housing crisis, and avoiding lawsuits from the fire. But people in underground spaces are also walking a tightrope of their own, trying to recover from a tragedy while fighting to keep their community together. Jonas Strauss from the Oakland Warehouse Coalition explains.
Right now, the warehouse community is not holding any shows. We're not holding any art shows. All underground art and music in Oakland has stopped. There are no events.
Everyone is trying to figure out how to handle this unprecedented tragedy. And in a city that is in the middle of a real identity crisis and is also known for doing things outside the system, this fire feels like a watershed event. This is a community that's still grieving. Some people lost many, many friends the night of the fire. What is Oakland supposed to do with this? Under the highway, near Jack London Square, there's a small structure in front of the community art space Oakland Secret. It's the size of a large wooden shed, made with pretty, nailed-together old windows, and, most importantly, there's a small, disconnected rotary phone on the shelf. It's a phone booth to speak with the dead, made by Oakland resident Jordan Baxter Stern.
After the Ghost Ship fire, my friend Donalda died in that fire, and my whole community was and is incredibly tore up, and so it felt like this could be a cool way to help us grieve and accept the death of our friends and kind of bring that into our life.
He made this with his friends, and I actually helped him build it. And it helps, at least a little bit. He picks up the phone and dials.
Hey, Donalda, you're on the air. We love you. We'll talk to you later. Bye.
Underneath the Nimitz Freeway in Oakland, this is Jeremy Dalmas for Cross Currents.
The city is slowly considering the Oakland Tenant Protection Ordinance, but it could be months before a decision gets made. Until then, warehouse dwellers are in limbo about what their future will be. Do you have questions about the lasting effects of the Ghost Ship fire? Send us an email, economy@kalw.org. Today's Cross Currents team includes Josiah Luis Alderete, Hanat Baba, Leela Day, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Nicole Grigg, Olivia Henry, Angela Johnston, Greer McVeigh, Ted Muldoon, Lisa Morehouse, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, and Andrew Stelzer. Today's show was engineered by James Rollins. The line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Our news director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. You're listening to Them or Us Too, whose bandmate Cash Askew died in the Ghost Ship fire. All the music you heard in this show was from victims of the fire or people scheduled to play that evening. Go to kalw.org, click Cross Currents for more information. For KALW News, I'm Julie Kane.